This episode of the Slash Filmcast is brought to you by Casper Mattresses. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/filmcast and using promo code filmcast at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. This episode is also brought to you by HelloFresh. Please visit HelloFresh.com and use the promo code FILMCAST30 to save $30 off your first week of deliveries when you subscribe.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me are...
Devendra Hardwar.
And Jeff Cannata.
Welcome to the show, everyone. What we do here on this podcast typically is we talk about what we've been watching, we move on into a discussion of some film news that's been going on this week, and then we conclude with an in-depth review. This week, we'll be reviewing American Made with writer Lindsay Romaine. So looking forward to talking about that movie with Lindsay. But before we get to that, a few things I just want to mention. First of all, you can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. You can email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. And I feel we would be remiss if we didn't mention that there are just a lot of things going on in the world right now. Take your pick of whatever is going on. But I think it's safe to say that, you know, for me personally, and I'm sure for you guys as well, 2017, from a news consumer's perspective, has been a festival of horrors. There's not a day that goes by where I haven't been emotionally crushed by something happening in the news. And during this time, I have personally struggled mightily with how we should run this podcast. Should we use our platform to comment on all the stuff going on? Should we continue to offer people escapism and a celebration of what we love about pop culture and entertainment? I don't think there's actually a right answer to that question. I think there's value in both approaches. But overall, we've definitely settled on the latter approach, where we kind of just try to have fun around here and comment on all the stuff that we usually comment on. But just because we're doing that, it doesn't mean that we're not thinking about all the people whose lives are affected by these daily tragedies that we read about. It doesn't mean that we're not processing them and trying our best to figure out how we can make a difference in our own lives. So all that being said, we're going to try to have some fun today, but that doesn't mean that we're not thinking about all of you and hoping that you are okay. So just wanted to say that at the top of the show.
Most definitely. And honestly, you know, there are things people can do too. If you feel helpless and powerless amidst this insanity, there are a lot of things. If you work for a company that matches donations and you want to help out with the hurricane in Puerto Rico and the recovery there, see if your company will help out with that too, but also donate, help. If you care about gun violence, you can call your representatives, just like people were doing for healthcare. It's all important.
Yeah, and if you're in Las Vegas, you can donate blood. You know, like there's a lot of things people can do. Jeff, I know, you know, you run a few other podcasts, and this has probably been a topic that you've struggled with as well, right?
Yes, mightily, as you said. It is, you know, obviously not about me. There are people who are suffering much more profoundly than I in all parts of the world right now. But when I wake up and read about these things, my first thought is, how the hell do I do my job today? And I'm sure many people think that it...
Mm-hmm. Right, because your job, like most, your full-time living is basically entertaining people and like commenting on, you know,
talking about pretty frivolous stuff,
fun
in the
things,
grand
right?
scheme of things.
Yeah, yeah. Trying to bring joy to people's lives, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, and as much of a tragedy as these things are, these global disasters and these mass shootings and all kinds of what have you, they are profoundly impactful to the people that are at the center of them. And I can't approach that kind of pain and suffering, but I think they affect all of us. These are psychic traumas as well to everyone, and so we all share in that pain to a certain degree. And I think what you said is something that I definitely struggle with. Where do you place that line between addressing it and talking about it like we are now, or providing people a quote unquote escape? And I think for me, my personal choice as a creator is to do both. And I refuse, and many people have written to me and said they are no longer listening to this show or that show of mine for this reason. But for me, it is a worthy sacrifice to lose some listeners here or there, because I refuse to separate the two. I refuse to separate one part of my life from another. I don't think they are separatable. I think that I bring my whole self to any kind of endeavor. And if I'm going to be talking about movies, or I'm going to be talking about video games, or I'm going to be talking about anything, I am a product of where I am at that time and what I've experienced and the stresses and pressures. And just as much as I will tell a story about my family or my childhood or the movie that I fell in love with when I was 8, I'm also going to be affected by the thing that I read on the news this morning and the things that are consuming my fears and anxieties and hopes and dreams in modern news culture. So the idea of being able to sort of arbitrarily separate those things and say, only talk about movies or only talk about video games, I find to be a false premise, mm-hmm. and not one I'm interested in at all. So I think people should be aware that we're going to, at least I'll just speak to myself, I'm going to bring all of that stuff to what we're talking about. And it may frustrate people when I say, hey, you know, watching a, what's the Keanu movie? When
John Wick.
Watching a John Wick right after a mass shooting was hard for me. I can only speak from the honest place of that moment, right? So that's what's going to happen, and it may turn some people off, but I say so be it, because that's all I can do.
Yeah, and Jeff, you know, you fully have our support in that, and you know, it's not as though we never talk about the things going on in the world on this podcast. You know, it's just like it has just been a challenge of what to focus on and what aspects of our thinking on world events to bring through during the show. And so, right. Of course, we're always open to your feedback, always open to your thoughts on how we should approach things. You can always email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com, but we're doing our best to strike a balance. And hopefully enough people find that satisfying enough to continue listening. So all that being said, let's move on and talk about the stuff we do best on the show, which is stuff that is of no consequence to anyone. Speaking of which, Avatar. So we got dozens of tweets this weekend when Saturday Night Live, in its season premiere, devoted, I want to say, a 4-minute sketch to Papyrus, the font that is used in the James Cameron film Avatar.
And to be clear, the sketch is about the font.
Yeah.
Not really the movie.
Well, okay. Sure, okay. So here's the thing. Here's the thing. For many months, Devendra Hardwar and myself, David Chen, have argued vehemently that Avatar is not culturally relevant. And that this is a movie that, you know, to quote like Scott Mendelson, the film critic and writer, was one of the biggest movies of all time, but seemingly left no cultural footprint whatsoever. And
the biggest movie of all time, right?
Yeah, the biggest movie of all time, and left seemingly no cultural footprint, right? And Devendra and I have argued not culturally relevant. And I can't speak for Devendra, but for me, one big piece of evidence for whether something is culturally relevant or not is whether it is lampooned on Saturday Night Live or not.
Huh.
Right? And this was the weekend where Avatar was finally lampooned on Saturday Night Live.
Stephen, not this again.
I forgot about it for years, but then I remembered that Avatar, the giant international blockbuster, used the Papyrus font as its logo.
Avatar, the movie from like 9 years ago?
Yeah, he just highlighted Avatar, he clicked the drop-down menu, and then he just randomly selected Papyrus, like a thoughtless child just wandering by a garden, just yanking leaves along the way.
And so now you're worried about the sequels that are coming out?
They're making more?
I would venture to say there's been an Avatar sketch before now. They dressed up in blue costumes before now. I believe they have.
I think they've done that. I don't. This is not lampooning Avatar, like specifically. This is a great sketch because it is about Well, I don't know if you want to explain it more.
Yeah. So the sketch is about Ryan Gosling plays just a random dude who is obsessed with the graphic designer who made the Avatar Papyrus font, right? And
The one who made the Avatar logo using Papyrus, a pre-existing font in Windows. It's the sheer laziness of that act. That's what the sketch is about. The sketch is not about the movie.
Just to be clear, as someone points out in the sketch, the font has clearly been modified. So it's not exactly Papyrus, but it's pretty close.
Nothing less interesting than dissecting comedy, but I will say the only reason that this sketch works is because his position is that this movie is so big and so important and there's such a big budget. How could they possibly just go with a standard off the shelf font? That's true. The joke. The joke doesn't work.
Actually, Jeff, I submit to you,
you've never heard of.
Jeff, I submit to you that is not the joke. The joke is that no one gives a shit about Avatar. And if this was like the font in a Marvel film, it would not be nearly as funny because people actually know and like Marvel films.
The one reference to the actual movie in the sketch is the wife character saying, you mean that movie from 2009? Like that's the extent to which she refers to the movie. He's obsessed about, and I think what's funny about the sketch is that it's everything we're talking about. How could a movie so huge? So the biggest movie ever leaves such a small footprint. His obsession is how could the biggest movie ever use a cheap ass font like that? That's the ultimate joke there for me.
But that doesn't mean the movie didn't have that doesn't mean that the joke can exist in absence of the movie. That it requires a movie
to make fun of the movie. Yes, that's what it requires. It requires the movie to be there and to be hugely successful and to be like, why is this? And then that's the joke.
Yeah, if it was a movie that people cared about, then I don't think it would be as funny is the point, right? So basically, Jeff,
now
I'm saying, basically, Jeff, I'm saying one step forward. I'm saying one step forward, two steps backward for your argument. OK, on the one hand, it was on SNL. It was glorious. It was very funny.
Yes.
But on the other hand, on the other hand, I think the sketch fundamentally wouldn't have worked if the movie was more popular and better liked.
Yeah, if everyone loved Avatar, like if it was a beloved film that was being referenced all over the place that we remembered fondly, it wouldn't quite work. That one line, you mean that movie from 2009? Like the joke falls apart, basically.
I think you guys are looking through it through a lens of hate, but that's fine.
No,
but
the
thing that bothers me most about this and other opinions on this movie is there's this bizarre need for your side to impose a forced consensus that the entire world hates this movie and there's no one who likes it. The way you guys talk about it, like everyone hates it, no one remembers it, nothing is good has come from it. This weird and nothing bothers me more than forced consensus. It is this strange position to take where we all think this, so everyone must think it, rather than say that there's room for a little bit of nuance in there.
All right.
I'm sure. I think you're reading too much into what we're saying. I'm just saying my opinion, and I've backed it up with arguments. And
I think you're taking it too seriously. Anything we have to say about this topic, Jeff?
Yes, for sure.
No. I'm not. I'm
yet to see a good the thing is, we've debated this for so long. I still have yet to see a good reasoning for what is the cultural impact if we are definitely wrong about this and its lasting impact on the culture. I'm still waiting for it. What I love is that we get artifacts like this, which keep reminding us that this movie happened and weird things about it still exist, like the use of the Papyrus font, which, yes, it's a slightly tweaked version of a pre-existing font, almost like a slightly tweaked version of Dances with the Wolves.
Makes you think. So there was the line in the sketch that made me laugh the most was when Ryan Gosling's character said they're making more of them because he didn't even know that James Cameron has officially begun production of four consecutive Avatar sequels, which are apparently expected to have a collective budget of $1 billion. So production began this week, I think, the last week or so. Mm-hmm. So Avatar, at the very least, Avatar 2 is actually happening. Jeff Cannata, how psyched are you for this?
Very. And you are all going to go see it, and you are all going to eat your words when it blows your socks off, and you're all going to apologize to me and be like, oh my God, these movies really are really entertaining and fun. I can't believe I was so cynical this whole time. They're going to be really fun movies. I'm not saying they're going to win Oscars. I'm not saying they're going to be the best movie you've ever seen. I didn't think that Avatar was the best movie I'd ever seen. I saw it a bunch of times in the theater. I loved it. It entertained the hell out of me. It's memorable. It was at a wonderful time in my life. I had so much fun watching those movies. They made me cry when I watched them. I love Avatar, and I'm excited there are more sequels. James Cameron always seems to deliver, and I think nobody seems to remember how all of his movies, that when they announced the budget, oh my God, there's problems on Titanic. Who's going to go see that? Everybody knows the ending. The press, nobody remembers that stuff back then, but the press was having a field day.
You're definitely saying these movies are sure to be a success, right?
Who's talking about
implied consensus now, Jeffrey?
I'm saying I have faith that these movies are going to be awesome, and you are all going to want to go see them. Everybody that has fun with their cynical little snide comments now are all the same people that went and saw it the first time and are all going to go and see it the second time, because it's going to blow the doors off of cinema. It's going to be awesome, and everyone's going to love
money.
It.
I think they're going to make a shit ton of money. They may be the first movie series to make, whatever past the current Avatar, but $10 billion. I don't know. I'm sure they'll be wildly successful. I just hope I remember it. That's what I'm hoping for, a memorable experience. Mm.
Yeah, you're really laying down a bunch of track here for one of the biggest bets ever on the Slash Filmcast, you know?
Yeah, I feel confident.
You're saying it's going to be fun and that it's going to do well, right? Pretty much is what you're saying. So
yes.
And one of
I
us
say
is going to look...
Everybody that right now is like, are going to be in line on day one with their tickets, because the trailers are going to knock everyone's socks off and everyone's going to be excited about the next big spectacle from James Cameron that is doing things that no movie has ever done before.
All right. Well, I love bringing this up every single time, Jeff, because it means that you've made a bunch of declarative statements, predictive statements may not prove to be true. One of us is going to look really dumb.
We can just all these together to be an Avatar prediction episode.
There's going to be best of Jeff Cannata on Avatar. It'll be 90 minutes long. It's just Jeff talking about Avatar.
But the implied... inverse is true from your side. If you're doubting Thomas is over here, then you are making a prediction just as bold that it will be none of the things I'm saying, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I have never definitively said that. I have made statements about the first movie, which are definitely we've backed up several times.
I think Devendra's statements about the first movie are pretty defensible, but yes. Anyway, it was a great sketch on Saturday Night Live. We'll link to it in the show notes. Check
Came
it
out of
out.
Nowhere. Yeah.
Came out of nowhere, yeah, that they devoted like 3 minutes to it. And it was very well shot, very funny. Ryan Gosling really committed to the role. I thought it was hilarious. And also, I continue to be delighted that anytime Avatar is mentioned anywhere in pop culture, at least one of us is going to get a tweet about it. So it's a long-running joke.
Just start sending out those tweets and articles about how culturally irrelevant Avatar is, too, by the way. Like, those are the stuff that gets floated around whenever the movie's talked about. I'm still waiting for those great, glorious think pieces about how great of an experience that movie was. I don't know. I don't see those.
Nobody writes those because cynicism and snarkiness rule the day.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, a likely story, Jeff. A likely story. Anyway, speaking of transcendent theatrical experiences, guys, A Ghost Story.
Uh-huh.
This is the new movie by David Lowry, and it came out in theater. It was like a A24 release. We always love what that company distributes, and it was kind of out in theaters for like a couple weeks this summer. Blink and you missed it. Limited release, you know, not
what
a wide,
cast.
Not, yeah, amazing cast. Rooney Mara, Casey Affleck, you know, it not a mass appeal movie, mm-hmm. but definitely a provocative one. That's definitely a movie, not quite as polarizing as Mother, but I think it's a movie that you kind of either love or you hate, because it definitely is a movie that's not for everyone, you know? Mm-hmm. When I saw Mother, it's like, that's not for everyone. Same thing with A Ghost Story. So we have a Blu-ray, three copies, actually, of A Ghost Story on Blu-ray that we're going to give away this week. And as usual, we're going to ask you guys to email in some contest entries. Here are the rules. All you got to do is email into us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com by Friday, 11:59 p.m. Pacific time. In the subject line, write A Ghost Story Contest. That's A Ghost Story Contest. And in the email itself, just write us a few lines about the scariest movie experience you ever had. So A Ghost Story Contest, and in the body of the email, write to us about the scariest movie experience you've ever had. Also include your mailing address, and this is unfortunately for U.S.-based people only. But yeah, that is the contest to win one of three copies of A Ghost Story on Blu-ray. And I think it's out on Blu-ray, like by the time you're listening to this, it'll be out mm-hmm. on Blu-ray already. So it's a great Blu-ray. There's a commentary by David Lowery on it. Comes with a digital copy as well. But yeah, if you want to enter the contest, email slashfilmcast@gmail.com. A Ghost Story Contest in the subject line. And write to us by Friday, October 6th, 11:59 p.m. Pacific time, with your scariest movie experience ever. Put your address in the email too. That would really help us out. Okay. All that said, Devinder Hardwar, I know you actually watched mm-hmm. A Ghost Story recently, right?
Yeah, I checked out the Blu-ray that we were sent as well, and this movie is fantastic. It is one of those small, quiet movies that I think leaves a big impact on your heart and your soul. Like, I'm left thinking about it a week after I've seen it, and I'll be thinking about like the themes and ideas in this film for a long time. It's beautiful, like so much of David Lowery's stuff. And it's just so unique, too, because it's shot in a 4x3 style, but also with, like, what, rounded framing, too? Like, it's a very specific look. And, you know, it's the sort of thing, like, I do feel like if you're watching this on a TV that's not even, that's under 50 inches or something, like, the movie may even appear very small to you. That's just because of the way it's shot.
Like, physically
frame.
Very small because
physically very
it's,
small,
yeah, like,
yeah.
It's 4x3 aspect ratio, yeah.
Yeah, it's, like, very 4x3, too. Like, they do crop in a little bit. But it's a beautiful film. Great experience. Tremendous soundtrack, too. It's, like, it's all very haunting. Also really interesting to see a movie starring Casey Affleck where he's basically not there or not, you know, you can't see him for
apparently
90% of it.
It is yeah. him under the sheet, apparently. So, yeah. But I thought it was definitely one of those movies that made me think a lot about life. I think you said, like, I'm going to just lie down and contemplate this for eternity, right? When you mm-hmm. when you saw it, Devendra. It's definitely a movie that, it reminds me of Terrence Malick's A Tree of Life, actually.
Sure,
which
yeah.
like started when the dinosaurs, you know, were around and like went all the way to the creation of the universe and the farthest reaches of the galaxy and related it to this tiny, tiny, tiny story in this rural area and makes you contemplate like what is the meaning of life in the midst of this vast expanse? What's the meaning of life in the midst of like eternity when your life is just like a blink of an eye compared to the timescale of the universe? Makes you think about those questions.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Cannata, you seen this movie yet?
I haven't. I'm very excited. My Blu-ray just arrived, and I'm excited to check it out. Very curious. I like any actor that does his own sheet work.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, totally. I will say this. You know, I don't believe this is spoilery. The way they do the sheet in the movie is really, really well done. Like, it's not just a sheet with eye holes in it. You know, it's like there's black, like when you look through the
yeah,
eye holes,
you
it's
can't
like black
see
underneath.
The eyes.
Yeah, you
yeah.
can't see the eyes, and there's you never see the seams, in yeah. my opinion, of like
next generation sheet technology.
It's yeah. next generation sheet technology. It's like really good sheet work. I know it sounds
it's
like I'm joking.
Sheet.
I'm being 100% serious.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's hot sheet. That's exactly right. Okay, so if you want to win one of three copies, again, slashfilmcast@gmail.com by Friday. 11:59 p.m. Pacific time, and a ghost story contest. The subject line, let us know your scariest movie experience. Great Blu-ray, great movie, provocative movie, not for everyone. Looking forward to reading your entries.
Speaking of doing your own sheet work, fellas, I do my own sheet work on a mattress, but it has to be a good mattress. Can't be a bad mattress. Got to replace those mattresses. I once took the mattress that I went from college. I took from my home to college and then took that from college into my life and slept on it many, many years. And then I started getting weird back pains and I couldn't figure out why. It turned out I needed a new mattress, and I didn't understand that until Casper came along. Casper is a way for you to get a high-quality mattress at a very reasonable price. And this is because Casper has cut out the middleman. You don't have to go into a stupid warehouse store and try to lay down on a mattress for a couple of minutes and figure out if it's going to be comfortable enough for you. Meanwhile, a high-pressure salesman is standing over you waiting for you to make a decision. None of that. You don't want to waste your afternoon or your President's Day weekend doing that. People do that. People waste their President's Day weekend at the mattress sale. No, be smart. Use Casper. Order a mattress from your home. Don't even worry about all of that garbage. Just have it sent directly to your house in an easy package like I did, like you guys have done. It is so easy. It comes to your house. You unfold it. It inflates on its own. Well, it doesn't.
Yeah, you like you cut open this box and then like it just like auto inflates. It's like you
it
when
bursts
you see
into life.
When you see the box, you can't believe the whole mattress is inside it. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I see people with Casper boxes on messenger bikes, guys. Like just biking these boxes around.
That's crazy.
Pretty crazy.
That's insane.
Just like you can't believe that Casey Affleck is in that sheet. You will not believe that a Casper mattress is in that box. This is an easy way to get a mattress. And the best part is that you then have 100 nights to make your final decision as to whether or not you want to keep this mattress. Chances are you're going to love it because it's super comfortable. It's made from very high quality materials, and it has gotten extremely high marks from consumers all across the country. Over 20,000 reviews with an average of 4.8 stars. That's pretty darn cool. But the best part is, if for any reason you don't want it, over 100 nights of trying it out, you can just say, hey, I want my money back. Somebody will come and pick it up, take it away for you, give you your money back. That's how confident Casper is. We all have Casper mattresses. We all sleep soundly. It's good stuff. Also, we're going to help you out. We're going to give you $50 toward any mattress purchase. All you got to do is visit casper.com/filmcast and use our promo code filmcast at checkout. And you get $50 off your purchase of a new mattress. Treat yourself. Feel better. Sleep better. Have a better night's sleep. It's really worth it. Do some sheet work. Casper.com/filmcast and the promo code filmcast.
Thanks to Casper for sponsoring us. All right, fellas, let's move on to what we've been watching this week. I had a chance to see Battle of the Sexes. You guys heard of this movie? This movie's pretty well on the – yeah, Jeff, you have a chance to see it. I'm going to read the plot summary from the internet here. The 1973 tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs became the most watched televised sports event of all time. Trapped in the media glare, King and Riggs were on opposite sides of a binary argument, but off court, each was fighting more personal and complex battles. This movie stars Emma Stone and Steve Carell playing the real-life characters or the real-life people, Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, respectively. Overall, I thought this movie was pretty good, Jeff. I liked it. I think it was not a subtle movie. You know, it was like occasionally extremely on the nose in terms of the messages, sometimes very after-school special-ish in terms of how it's trying to convey its messages. But it was very enjoyable. I thought Emma Stone and Steve Carell both did a great job. And the tennis was very good. I thought it was very convincing. I'm not a tennis expert at all. But my fiance actually is a tennis expert, and she also thought the tennis was very good. So I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really interesting depiction of, sadly, a kind of debate and a battle that still rages on to this day in some ways. And what do you think of it, Jeff Cannata?
Yeah, I liked it too. It is much more of a love story and a personal story than I anticipated going in. And I agree with you that the tennis is really believable and effective. As the movie progresses inevitably toward the big match at the end, I kept thinking to myself, man, I wish in a movie like this, which is a dramatization of real events and casts these people as, real people, I wish a filmmaker would just get to the point of going, and now real footage from the match, and just abandon the need to keep convincing us that it's Steve Carell and Emma Stone, right? Because I would just love to watch the actual edit of the match to see how they played. But I was thinking that as we were running up to that moment, and in the moment I was like, maybe they used real footage and just CGI'd it.
That's how convincing it is, you're saying, right?
That's how well it comes off. It's remarkable. They don't cheat by using, you know, absurd close-ups of the actors' faces just wildly swinging, and then it doesn't feel like a cheat. You see the match shot from the way tennis matches are shot, and they are doing very exaggerated, extreme physical things. I assume they were all doubled, or maybe they did use some of the authentic footage. I'm not really sure. It's clearly visual wizardry went into it, but it was all very effective. And my favorite part, actually, is that they also used the real Howard Cosell commentary throughout the match, which is so revealing as to how far we've come. he's saying some just casually offensive things throughout, and I loved the fact that they used his real footage and his real voice.
You can't fake that voice either, right? If you fake Howard Cosell, you could tell.
Right. I mean, I guess they could get, somebody from the 80s, like every Howard Cosell, impressionist from the 80s did a Howard Cosell. But I enjoyed it. I thought it didn't do as well a job as I had hoped in describing the environment culturally around the event.
I agree.
You sort of follow these two personal lives, and then you get to the event and you see the size and scale. It's like, 90 million people are watching on TV, and you see all of the circus that's part of it. But we don't understand why 90 million people tuned in. We don't see why it became such a cultural touchstone that everyone who was alive at that time had a vested interest in. You kind of see that happening as the match is going on, but we don't get any context for why that was created. I felt like that was a little deficient in the storytelling, but it definitely was a movie that decided it wanted to be about these two people and their personal lives. And I thought that was effective, but I just wish the movie had been a little bit broader also in context.
Yeah. I agree. I think some of the context was really lacking, and particularly with like Bobby Riggs, I felt like the movie did a pretty poor job explaining like his place in the tennis universe. I thought it was a fine performance by Steve Carell, but just like I got a much better sense of Billie Jean King's story than I did of Bobby Riggs, even though this movie is theoretically about like the battle of the two of them.
It clearly chooses sides. This movie is not trying to be objective at all.
Totally. And I think that's completely fine. But, you know, the comment I made earlier, women are still fighting for equal pay and equal rights. And one of Billie Jean King's biggest achievements was like fighting for Title IX, which, as you might have seen recently in the news, is not necessarily something that is staying unchallenged, right?
So, not safe,
So on the one hand, it's a very like encouraging, heartening film. On the other hand, it's also depressing given, viewing it in light of today's reality. So,
The thing that I took away from the movie most that really actually choked me up and got me emotional toward the end is how important the struggle is to the marginalized half, and how much of a joke it is to the privileged half, right? And that really resonates today, that it's all just a game and a joke and a frivolous endeavor for the people in a position of privilege. And for the other people who are struggling, who are fighting for rights, it couldn't be more vital, right? And that really came through in this movie for me. Like, it's just a gag. He's not even being serious. It's like he's saying these offensive things as to pull people's chains and to create and to make money. It's really about just making money. And that really resonates with today, where people can push buttons and create awful things in the world and marginalize people. And it's just a game. They don't care because they can. And yet for the people on the other side of that, it is life and death, and it is a struggle with meaning and impact. And I don't know. It really got me emotional toward the end of this movie.
Yeah, yeah. So it is a movie that definitely is effective in some regards and worth checking out. So that's Battle of the Sexes. It's out, I think, in many theaters this weekend. Check it out if you have a chance. Divin, your heart, or what have you been watching this week?
A bunch of stuff, guys. I saw Gerald's Game, which is the new Stephen King adaptation on Netflix, directed by Mike Flanagan, a horror thriller director. I'm just really digging his stuff these days. He did Ouija 2,
Origin
Oculus.
Of Evil.
Yeah, Origin of Evil.
Still
Oculus.
Ouija.
Still Ouijan. Oculus, the really good Haunted Mirror movie, which is more effective than like its description sounds. And Hush, that movie too, about like the deaf woman who's being stalked in the woods in a house all by herself. He's just really good at this genre material. And I think he mostly hits this movie out of the park. This movie is about a married couple that goes off to a lake house to kind of rekindle their relationship a little, maybe have some sexy times. And things go badly, guys. And it's very, very, like, I haven't read the short story, but in ways it reminds me of Misery, another Stephen King, you know, story about bad things happening on a bed. I won't say too much about this movie. Basically, it stars Carla Gugino, who is awesome. And this is probably one of her best performances ever. And Bruce Greenwood as her husband, a guy who is... He is shirtless for a lot of this movie, and this guy is way too old to be this, like, packed. Like, his abs are amazing for his age. Just want to say this. She spends most of the movie, I'd say 90% of the movie, tied to the bed, trapped to the bed. And it's all about her fight for survival. This movie is fantastic, guys. Like, it is a effective thriller. It's an exploration of sexual assault. And, you know, just one woman trying to find her inner strength. It's really great. And I'm not going to say much about it except watch it. Maybe don't watch it while you're eating. One recommendation, like with many Stephen King movies. But yeah, this is definitely the year of Stephen King adaptations. And this is definitely one of the better ones.
Are you saying that we're in some sort of Kingissance?
Yeah. Yes, I am. And actually, Netflix has another one coming out later this year, too, I think. So it's crazy.
I've heard Gerald's Game is great. And so good. It's a very difficult to adapt novel, apparently. So even more impressive that it came out well. So,
you know what else we're in, guys? And nobody's talking about it. Not enough people are talking about it. A Robin Wright-assance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She is assancing all over the place.
Yeah, that's been happening for a while.
I don't know. I guess I feel like House of Cards ushered in the Robin Wright
assance. House of Cards was the beginning, right? But now she's all in the Wonder Woman. She's in the Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. She's assancing. She's just like, she's full assancing, guys. Mm.
She's in full assance, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Gerald's Game is on Netflix right now, right, Devendra?
For sure, yeah. It's there and, yeah, easily accessible. Check it out.
What else have you been watching, Devendra?
Also been checking out Neo-Yokio, and this is a new anime-esque, it's an animated series created by Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend. Stars Jaden Smith, Jude Law as a robot butler. Like, it's an American made but Japanese produced show, so they're doing it in the style of anime. Kind of has the same character designs and like anime mannerisms. And this show is about a rich kid in New York City, and like Neo-Yokio is sort of like a future different version of New York City. Basically a rich kid dealing with rich kid problems. I think the description of the show doesn't sound that interesting, but the voice work, Jude Law's here, Susan Sarandon, Jason Schwartzman, of course, Richard Ayoade, like a ton of great voice actors. It's a really sweet show. And just like dryly funny at times. Like, it has a very, maybe a bit of a Wes Anderson vibe to it. But it's really sweet, even though it's ultimately about rich people problems. And I also just think it's really cool to see people who probably grew up watching anime basically getting to make their own shows. Yeah, this is very interesting. It sort of reminds me of a little bit of like how Avatar The Last Airbender came about and Legend of Korra and all that stuff, except this is it's kind of like a high society farce. And if you're into anime, definitely worth checking out. It's just really unique.
That's Neo Yokio. How did you view it, Devendra Hardware?
It's on Netflix. On Netflix has everything, guys.
Neo Yokio on world. Netflix. All right, what else have you been watching, yeah. Devendra?
I also finished the season of Top of the Lake, Top of the Lake Season 2, China Girl. And if you haven't seen this yet, do so right now. It is fantastic. It is a great murder mystery, but also a great character drama. If you enjoy Top of the Lake Season 1, it builds on the characters, specifically Elizabeth Moss's detective character, who is, you know, even like in a way, like she is kind of broken and just trying to put herself together in the season. And it's just really heartening. When I talked about it before, I didn't even mention Nicole Kidman is in the series, and she's playing like an overbearing Australian mother. And the show kind of tries to, I think it tries to age her naturally in a way too. Like, it's Nicole Kidman, not super glamorous, but with like, you know, pimples and acne on her face and like a graying hair, but she still is like a towering presence. Great casting, great story. I think just like season one, the plot elements sometimes get a little wonky. I think there's a bit of convenience going on, but I think the texture of the show is so good. Like, it just really gets you a sense of like what it's like to be like in Sydney, Australia. And it tries to, you know, cover broader themes like sex workers and the exploitation of, you know, immigrant Asian women in Australia today. It's trying to do a lot of things, and I think it accomplishes most of it. And this show has some of the best episode breaks that I can think of. Like, just something insane happening right at the end that really makes you want to go into the next episode. So just, you know, I think that all works out really well. And this is the Jane Campion produced series too. Like, she just has such a great eye. I believe she directed all these episodes, or at least most of them. This show just looks incredible and definitely worth watching. It's on Hulu right now too, so you don't need to have Sundance Channel to see it.
Top of the Lake seasons 1 and 2, right, are on Hulu.
Yep.
Yeah. All right.
They get to the rest of the lake at some point.
Yeah. The bottom of the lake, the middle of the lake.
It's a process.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's what Devendra's been watching. Jeff Cannata, how about you? What have you been watching?
I have been watching the second season. It's 3 episodes so far of Better Things, which is on FX. This is the show. Oh, why did her name just jump out of my
Pamela
head?
Pamela Adlon.
Pamela Adlon, yes. Pamela Adlon's show that she's making with Louis C.K. Louis C.K. is credited as a writer on a lot of these episodes in season 2. And Pamela Adlon, who stars, and it's ostensibly about her life, is also directing all of the episodes, at least so far. I enjoyed this show a lot in season 1. I kind of described it as Louis, but from a female perspective. And I think the second season is already, in just 3 episodes in, is wildly better. It feels like it has really grown into its own and is deeper, richer, more interesting, funnier. I really, really love Better Things. It's beautiful. Pamela Adlon isn't afraid to show herself in very unflattering lights and kind of show warts and all what it's like to be a single mother of a certain age. And it feels very honest and very raw. She has a wonderful love-hate relationship with her own kids. She's searching for love. She's searching for friendship. She's abrasive in certain ways. The first episode of this season is about her daughter dating an older man. Her daughter's like 15, 16, dating an older man, like 30-year-old guy. It's handled in such an interesting way. It's funny and deft and poignant. And then the most recent episode co-stars Henry Thomas, Elliot from E.T. He puts in a really lovely performance. The second episode was about her sort of discovering her priorities in life. All of them have been so powerful, and I'm just I really dig the show. I think it's found a voice that I don't even think it had in the first season. It's just
this
great.
Season. It's really good. I'm really digging it. Also, Henry Thomas is in Gerald's Game, playing a very creepy character. So it was really weird seeing him in Better Things right after that movie. Just putting that out there.
We might be at the beginning of some sort of
Thomas Assance.
I don't want to say it, guys, but I don't want to jinx the Assance.
Yeah, Jeff, you've made me hate myself for using Assance too much.
Then my work here is done.
So that's Better Things, and it's on FX right now. Jeff, what else have you been watching?
I also saw the triumphant return of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Season 9 premiered this weekend. Episode 1. It's back. Larry David's show about Larry David and his you know, cranky life. This show, it's like stepping back in time. It's like it's really a strange experience for me watching Curb Your Enthusiasm now, because it is comedy and perspective from a much simpler age. It really is. It reminds me of what it was like watching Curb Your Enthusiasm all those years ago when it was on consistently year after year on HBO, and the world seemed less dire, and that we could be mad at things that Larry David is mad at, you know, like the way shampoo comes out of a bottle, you know, like simpler frustrations. And now it just seems like, oh, you're making fun of that stuff. There's what much bigger things to worry about, Larry. but it's I don't know. It's like a little comforting blanket of like, oh, right. The early 2000s were so fun. it was so nice to be in 2010. It was great back then. So it's much of the same. It's like it's no different. It feels anachronistic now, but it is no different. So if you liked it then, chances are you might like it now.
That's Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's on HBO right now. And finally, Jeff, I think you wanted to give a shout out to the Blade Runner: The Final Cut, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. In anticipation of seeing Blade Runner 2049, I wanted to refresh myself on Blade Runner because I hadn't watched it in a long, long time. I know there's been 47 different cuts, now there's a final cut. There's the last cut.
Yeah, a lot of people have asked, like they've tweeted out, like which Blade Runner cut should I watch? You know, and the answer is the final cut. I think
the one called the final.
Yeah, it's called the final cut. I think it is the definitive cut.
Yes,
it should be called Watch This Cut.
Yeah, yeah, better word.
Although if somebody put a gun to my head and said, "What's different in this one from the last Blade Runner?" Well, I'm not sure I could tell them. I know there's different stuff, but like
dozens of changes. Yeah. Like, and a lot of it is like just very basic, like digitally cleaning up shots and stuff like that. But yeah, I've seen the director's cut. Like the director's cut was my first cut of Blade Runner that I watched. But
we always remember our first cut.
You always remember your first, not just first cut, your first Blade Runner cut, Jeff.
Right.
Final Cut's very good. And Jeff, it sounded like you were saying you're really glad you watched the Final Cut before you saw Blade Runner 2049, right?
That's really why I wanted to bring it up. I don't want to spoil it, but chances are you guys knew we were going to be talking about Blade Runner 2049 next week. And I would highly recommend, if you're planning to see that movie before our review or planning to see that movie at all, go rewatch Blade Runner 2049. I'm so glad I did. 2049 is very much a sequel. Very much a sequel. So you will be rewarded for having it fresh in your mind.
For sure.
Speaking of fresh things, Jeff.
Hello.
Hello. Fresh things.
Fresh. Hello, fresh things. Oh, Dave, that was so well done.
Thanks, man.
Gosh. It was like you set the ball and then I spiked it.
Yep.
HelloFresh is our sponsor. HelloFresh is meal delivery service. It is, honestly, it will change your life. I'm telling you, there's a lot of things in life that are nice and are quality of life improvements. This will change your life. If you are somebody who, like me, used to just eat whatever fast food or just even go out to nice restaurants, if you just ate whatever garbage you could stuff in your mouth at any given time because you needed sustenance, open yourself up to the idea of preparing food. It will change your life. It will improve your life in so many ways. And HelloFresh is the fresh way to do it. It's the quick and easy way to do it. They call themselves a farm-to-box company because they want everyone to have access to fresh ingredients. But they're also a couch-to-kitchen company because, like me, who used to sit on my couch eating garbage, now I'm in the kitchen. I'm taking an active role in what goes in my body and my family's body. I feel better. I'm enjoying meals more. I have more variety in what I eat. And my goodness, if you're a single person, I can't imagine anything better than inviting someone over and cooking a meal. There's nothing more intimate, more lovely than to share the process of preparing food. HelloFresh is the easy way to do that. You get little boxes. I love it because they come in little self-contained, each meal self-contained box has all the fresh ingredients that you might need to make that meal, and then clear step-by-step instructions on how to do it. This isn't like you read a recipe in a book that just gives you the steps of how to make it. This is like step-by-step of making the entire meal. Now you do this, then you do that.
Can't get enough eye-popping, jaw-dropping, heart-stopping reality TV.
It's the best.
Then head to Hey You, home of reality on demand. Stream and download the latest episodes from shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives, same day as the US.
What's more fun than that?
Or binge old faves like The Simple Life and The Hills.
That's hot.
Hey You, reality on demand. Start your 1 month free trial now.
Using the same pan, you do this. It's great. And it's inexpensive. You're going to be spending less than $10 per meal. HelloFresh employs two full-time registered dietitians, and they review each recipe to make sure it is nutritionally balanced. It comes right to your door in recyclable, insulated boxes. Always free shipping. You never have to worry about that. They have light summer meals. They've got breakfast options now. It's great. And we're going to give you a discount. We're going to give you $30 off your first week of HelloFresh. All you got to do is go to HelloFresh.com, put in our promo code, which is FilmCast30, because you get $30 off. It's easy to remember. FilmCast30 at HelloFresh.com. Try it out. Save $30. Try out your first few meals. I'm guaranteeing you, your life will change. It will be a completely new kind of experience if you've never known what it's like to cook. Anybody can do it. If I can do it, anybody can do it. HelloFresh.com, the promo code FilmCast30.
Right. That's FilmCast and then the numbers 30. So thanks to HelloFresh for sponsoring us. We really appreciate it. Okay. Guys, we got to move on. Before we get to our review, there is one brief film news item I wanted to bring up. And that is J.J. Abrams, guys. We didn't really have a chance to talk about the fact that J.J. Abrams, a few weeks ago, has announced he'd be directing the new Star Wars, Episode 9. I guess the folks at Lucasfilm thought, hey, there's one dude on the planet, other than Rian Johnson, we know, who can handle directing a Star Wars film, J.J. Abrams. But it also left open the question of, like, what is J.J. Abrams going to do aside from Star Wars movies? I mean, think about the movies J.J. Abrams has made, right? Mm-hmm. He's done Super 8, Star Trek 1 and 2, Mission Impossible 3, and then Star Wars Episodes 7 and 9, right? So out of all of those movies, his only original film is Super 8. And there's a lot of questions about, like, what is the trajectory of this guy's career, given that he was once hailed as a young Spielberg, super talented dude. And we got a little hint of that when it was announced recently that he would be directing a live action U.S. adaptation of the movie Your Name.
Do we know he's directing it, by the way? I know he's adapting it with Bad Robot. I don't know if we know for certain he's directing
it. I believe it's him directing it. I think it's him directing it. Eric Heiserer is writing the script. But
The Arrival guy. Yeah,
the guy who wrote Arrival. I'm Googling it, and it's looking like it's mm-hmm. his name is associated with it.
They're gonna produce
he's
it.
He's producing it. Yeah, he's producing, he's developing it. Right it. Yeah, it's unclear if he's directing it.
Interesting.
Your Name is one of my favorite movies of the year, and mm-hmm. I actually think this could be good. I think it, you know, it is, there is a lot of universality to that story of just like longing for another life is really what that movie's about. And I for one, am looking forward to our J.J. Abrams produced, possibly directed version of Your Name. But what do you guys think? Devendra, are you psyched for this?
I can't think of a U.S. remade version of an anime film that, that turned out well. And I had just seen Death Note a couple weeks ago, which was horrific. But yeah, there are universal themes to take out here. But also, you know, this has been explored a bit in other things like The Lake House, which was, you know, pretty popular, you know, romantic drama. So yeah, it could work. It just depends on how it's done. And it certainly won't have the like wonderful texture and cultural qualities that I really enjoy from the original film.
Yeah, I mean, the original is really incredible. And I would strongly recommend if you have a chance, get that Blu-ray whenever it comes out. It's a great film. It's a great film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope they keep the spit alcohol. They have to figure out how to work that in the Western version.
I had a feel. I knew you were going to bring up something really weird about the movie, Jeff, and you delivered. Yeah, there were a lot of really weird, culturally specific aspects of that film. Now that you mention it, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out in a U.S. version. Yeah, you know, looking online, there's like a lot of divergent information about J.J. Abrams' involvement, but I think him producing is probably the most likely scenario.
This guy's busy.
Yeah, the dude's
I feel like that whole Star Wars thing is going to take up some time.
Yeah, it's probably going to be the next 2 to 3 years of his life.
Yeah,
right. But
and we didn't talk too much about that. I can see why Disney ended up going with him. And the more I rewatch The Force Awakens, like the more I'm just like very satisfied with what went down with that movie. I just hope they can wrap up this trilogy pretty well, right? I think that's the thing people keep saying about JJ. He starts things. He's done pilots. He's done like the first film in series. He hasn't really ended things.
He's very good at rebooting things.
Yeah.
You know? Again, Mission Impossible, Star Trek, Star Wars. Mm-hmm. He's very good at rebooting things. But can he bring things to a satisfying conclusion? Yeah. We'll see.
And honestly, that's up to the script too. But you know,
yeah.
I think it's going to be amazing when we find out that there's a second Starkiller base, and the shield is on some sort of forest moon. That
yeah.
I mean, you know, Jeff, I know you're joking, but it's a distinctly possible outcome. I mean,
yeah.
Based on what happened with
yes, it is.
Yeah,
guys, a solar system sized weapon to destroy galaxies,
and it'll be on a forest location that we have to go to.
They're all forest planets, okay?
Well, I'm looking forward to anything J.J. Abrams does, but I do hope that he does branch out and do more interesting, original things that
he
aren't
wants
just
to be
rebooting
a blockbuster
things.
Guy like that. I don't blame him for that. That's what he wants to do. And,
yeah, I guess that is what he wants to do. Yeah,
that's
you're right.
What he wants.
You're right.
It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. And he's good at it, guys. It like I think back to specific episodes of Alias. There's a Super Bowl episode of Alias, which I think about a lot, which has a great opening action sequence and one of the best fight sequences ever in a TV show. And I thought to myself, like, this guy is going places. This guy wants to make fucking movies, you know? And he's doing it. So we'll
see.
And Super 8, he's making big, huge movies, and
if you look at like actual Steven Spielberg, I mean, I know Steven Spielberg is like a once in a generation or once in a century director, but it is interesting to see how his work has evolved over the years, you know, he's now, I don't know that I'm a fan of his later works as much as I'm a fan of Steven Spielberg's earlier works, but at least he's kind of, he has a distinct kind of worldview and a kind of messages he's trying to bring to the world, right?
And Spielberg has matured over time.
Right, too, exactly. So. And I don't know that... I'm just curious to see how like the latter part of Abrams' career is going to play out, because he's a guy who's, again, immensely talented. And I wonder if he's just going to be, you know, doing reboots and preordained blockbusters for the rest of his life. I hope he lends his talents to something like, you know, really bold and original and something like we've never seen or heard of before.
I'd hope
I think you guys are right in saying that he hasn't achieved that sort of Spielbergian potential. But I do think that Bad Robot is
yes.
to film what Amblin was.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I think it is. He has achieved that level of Spielbergianness.
Because they can do things like the Cloverfield series, right? They can have like cool little sci-fi projects, which I think in our typical studio system wouldn't be made. You know, unless you had this geeky dude who really wants to produce these things. So
it's true.
He has his fingers in many different pies, and he's definitely producing really cool stuff. And anytime there's a Bad Robot TV series, like I will certainly follow it.
Yeah, I think, and the same way that Amblin, you know, 20 years ago made it a must watch, and no matter what medium that it came out on, I think the same thing with Bad Robot. You have to pay attention because Bad Robot's title card is on it.
Can't disagree with you, Jeff. Cannot disagree. All right. Well, let's move on. Before we get to our review, we got to thank all the people who donated to the Slash Filmcast: Donald McCoy, Brian from Sydney, Australia, Caleb Masters from Oklahoma City, who also became a subscriber at the rate of $2 per month. Thanks so much for your donations. Thanks to new subscribers Victor Fuentes, Caleb Masters, and Christopher Rudd. We really appreciate it, guys, all your support, which helps us go to defray the cost of seeing movies and putting on the show. If you want to support the Slash Filmcast in that way, go to slashfilm.com, click on the Slash Filmcast tab, use the PayPal links on the side of the page. Let's get to our review of American Made.
This is the United States Drug Enforcement Agency. We are ordering you to land.
All right, boys, let's land.
What is he?
My name's Barry Seal.
Oh. As for the damage, for your sister, hey, little darling, and your back.
Some of this shit really happened.
You never saw me.
Top of your class in the Civil Air Patrol, a pilot like you shouldn't be flying buses.
Welcome to Miami. Welcome to Bakersfield.
Haven't you ever wanted something more, Barry?
You should be serving your country.
Your CIA.
That was from the trailer of American Made, the newest film by director Doug Liman, written by Gary Spinelli and starring Tom Cruise. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. A pilot lands work for the CIA and as a drug runner in the South during the 1980s. And today we have a special guest joining us for our review of American Made. She is a writer for places like Thrillist, Vulture, and SlashFilm.com. Lindsay Romaine, welcome to the Slash Filmcast. Lindsay, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, all things considered.
It's been a rough day.
Yeah.
Rough day.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But I'm doing good. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're so psyched to have you on. It was nice meeting you this summer at Con of Thrones, where you're covering it for SlashFilm.com. I've enjoyed your tweets over the last few months as well. So great to have you on to discuss American Made. So I was really nervous about going into American Made because the last two Tom Cruise movies I did not like, The Mummy and Jack Reacher Never Go Back. Damn. I felt like he was kind of an actor past his action movie prime, but still thinking that he was in his action movie prime.
Uh-huh.
And so I was wondering, like, would American Made, which pairs him up with Doug Liman, a guy who helped him make Live, Die, Repeat or Edge of Tomorrow, one of my favorite action movies of all time.
But also with a huge failure.
Just like not a big success, you know, financially. Would that be a fruitful pairing? Lindsay Romaine, what do you think of American Made? Do you feel like this is a great use of Tom Cruise's talents?
Not really. I think I'll just jump right in. Tom Cruise is someone who I'm definitely interested in. I think he's always a fascinating person on screen. I felt like he was phoning it in a little bit in American Made. I don't know that he felt as dynamic to me as I kind of was hoping for. I don't know. He kind of sucked the life out of it a little bit for me. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's a controversial opinion, but that's kind of how I felt walking out.
That's interesting because, you know, usually the one thing you can't accuse Tom Cruise of is phoning it in. Like, usually, whether he's hanging off the side of planes or jumping off tall buildings, like, he's usually really in it for everything. He got a new accent for this movie. That was interesting.
Kind of.
Yeah.
He got one.
Yeah, he went and picked one up at the corner store.
Accents R Us and purchased an accent.
That's right. That's right. But did you just feel like, did you just not believe him in the role? Or did you just find him like not energetic enough for what this role called for, Lindsay?
A little bit of both. I think maybe I was expecting something. Sort of the vibe I was getting off of this movie heading into it, even though I don't really know exactly why, but I was thinking like the nice guys, kind of like Ryan Gosling in that movie, you know, where there's like all of this energy and stuff. And I just feel like he didn't have that. Maybe I was missing something, but I didn't believe him in it really at all. I don't know. He did not connect with me at all. I left just wishing that he had gone a little weirder. Like, I just feel like the character it was like a great character that could have been very interesting and smarmy and all of these things. And I just don't feel like he went for it quite the way that he could have.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. Jeff Cannata, what do you think of Tom Cruise in American Made?
You know, I'm I guess a bit of a Tom Cruise apologist. I really, on screen, say what you will about the dude's private life, but I always find him so compelling. And I didn't get the phone it in vibe from this. And for the most part, I had a pretty good time. This is a sprawling rise and fall story, and those are generally entertaining to me. And I think there's an energy to just the sort of airplane-ness of this movie. There's a lot of airplane in this movie, and the way the airplane stuff is shot is pretty fun. There's a pace and a kinetic nature to just the sprawling all over the place from country to country, from island to island. It just feels like we're on an adventure at a high pace, and there is something that swept me up in all of that. My biggest problem with this movie, and this may be a Tommy Cruise issue, quite frankly, is it's completely amoral. It is a strangely, bizarrely, disturbingly amoral film. It shows this behavior that is quintessentially wrong and complicated and dark. I mean, it's basically a Goodfellas, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there is literally no downside to this guy. There's no.
I don't know if I agree with that.
There are some downsides.
Yeah, I think there are some pretty big downsides, Jeff. But okay.
But there are no negative qualities to this human being.
Oh, sure. To him as a person, you're saying?
Right.
That's what I'm saying. Yes.
Other than his horrible actions, though.
Yeah. He portrayed as just a great guy all the way through. Right. Uh-huh. He's just a fantastic fella who is doing really unethical things.
I think that is part of the point of the movie, too, though. Right.
Well, here's where I agree with Jeff on this is I don't know that I agree with you that he's portrayed as a great guy because he obviously does horrible things. But I think this movie has a bizarrely sterile approach to the drug trade.
Yes,
I mean,
sure.
Like, you never really see the horrors of what drugs like and the trafficking of them, like what they inflict on people, either from those using them or those who are killed in the trading of them, like that's completely absent from the movie. It feels like
it's about the glory side of the drug trade of the people who profit from it.
That's exactly right.
Oh no, I was gonna say, I think that's also kind of where my issues with Tom Cruise come in, is that if he had sold sort of this character as more of an asshole, and I think he could have done that if he had, you know, with certain just trying in a different way. I think if he had felt more like an asshole, it would have kind of helped some of those issues of it being amoral. It just didn't feel like he was too, like, I don't know. I don't know what the right word, not putting it in hard enough.
He's noble in this, like a noble thief, but he's like emphasis on the noble for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's an example of stuff we were talking about before you got here, Lindsay, but it's an example of how I watch movies now in a new way that I'm not entirely happy about, but I can't help but look at this and feel like this movie just assumes that naked capitalism is a positive thing. Like he's doing this stuff because people ask him to, and he makes money. And so that's just a positive thing. And here we go. And like, this is what any guy in this situation would do. And he's a family man and loves his wife and she loves him and they're super happy and he doesn't do anything wrong. And it's like, what? I don't find any of that remotely believable. Like, a guy wrapped up in this kind of chaos and wealth and, associating with all those folks, he's just never going to do anything
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you, Jeff. I mean, because I think, like, a movie that I saw recently that I didn't bring up and a movie I know you loved is The Founder, starring Michael Keaton, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that movie did a great job at portraying Michael Keaton as this craven capitalist who would do anything to get ahead. And that the moral of the story is one you need, you as the viewer need to impute on the film, right? Like you need you need to communicate what the, you need to like have the moral in your own mind, before going in. Like the movie doesn't need to do the moralizing for you. I feel like this movie is exactly the same way. I feel like
I really disagree strongly, Dave, because I think that's a perfect movie to bring up and show how Michael Keaton's performance, the script, the way the movie shot, it really shows warts and all of that guy. It makes him it shows how disturbed and vile and upset he was. This none of that with Tom Cruise.
I guess I disagree with that assessment of Tom Cruise's character in this movie. Yeah. Wow.
Another movie I kept thinking of too was Wolf of Wall Street. And sort of Leonardo DiCaprio in that movie where I don't know that movie comes down hard on any way either, but he's just so ridiculous and emasculated and crazy in that movie that like you can kind of come to the conclusion of like, oh yeah, I should think this guy sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, that one kept popping up a lot too.
Those are both good comparisons. You like Wolf of Wall Street, I think by the end of that movie, right, you're having fun, it's a good mm-hmm. fella's time for most of the movie, and then the shit kind of hits the fan. And I think the movie, like the weight of his monstrous decisions kind of comes to pass in that movie, and the audience starts to feel complicit. I don't know if honestly, part of the problem for The Founder for me is that I don't think that movie ever landed that right. It does show negative aspects of Ray Kroc, but also ends in a weirdly triumphant way for him. That movie, I think, is more confusing than even this one. Like, I do think. I'll talk more about like my overall thoughts in this movie at some point, but this film really assumes like, oh man, look, it's Tom Cruise, he's kicking ass, he's making money, he's like a real American man, like didn't you like Top Gun, this is that same dude same dude living the American dream, right? And I don't think it has to spell it out for you. Like, there are objectively bad things he's doing, and he's doing it with the Tom Cruise grin, and they're doing it with like fun 70s music. And like, it's just like a fun time. Everyone's having fun. You have drinks with like, Pablo Escobar and his crew. Like, it's all fun. Except I do think, as the audience, you could be like, what the hell is happening?
I just never got a sense of the danger in this movie. Mm-hmm. I know like at times he's arrested and, you know, there's a couple times he's arrested. He comes close to being arrested. Like, some people die tangentially in the movie. Mm-hmm. But I just never got a sense that like, his life was at stake, you know, mm-hmm. obviously until the latter part of the film. Like, and you just never got a sense that, like, this was a dangerous trade. It just felt like this, like you said, Devendra, this dude's having fun. He's making tons of cash, and that's it. Now, what I, the one thing I did like, so I'll just say I was fairly disappointed in this film. I didn't think it really added up to anything. Like, the story was a series of interesting events that mm-hmm. never grabbed me in any broader way. I never felt like the story coalesced into something that was greater than its parts. It just felt like, oh, here's a series of interesting events. I never thought, oh, what's going to happen to this dude? You know, what's going to happen with his family? Like, I never felt any attachment to this guy. And so, to that extent, I think the movie is a failure. But one thing that I did appreciate about the movie is the amorality of America, right? And mm-hmm. And how like nation building was a thing that people went into with gusto at one point in American history, not only thought it was okay, but like thought it was what represented the best about America. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating is, you know, we are in a situation right now where we feel like, hey, like Russia might have interfered with our elections. Dude, America used to assassinate people to get people elected in other countries. You know what I mean? And I feel like this movie doesn't address that kind of thing directly, but it kind mm-hmm. of is like, hey, America used to try to, you know, support certain parties, arm certain parties, and basically meddle in other people's affairs in major ways that made a lot of people rich and successful here. And that's pretty troubling. And I think that's, mm-hmm. that's one thing mm-hmm. that the movie gets across well. But that's probably the only thing that I really, really thought was good about the film. So anyway, any other thoughts before we get to spoilers? There's probably a couple of things I just want to say,
I mostly enjoyed this film, but I do think like everything you guys are saying is very true. Like it could have been sharper. It could have been a little more focused. Tom Cruise in this role is actually perfect because that is a great way to kind of trick the audience into thinking like, oh man, look how awesome this dude is. Like he's living the dream, he's making money for his wife and his family, and he has more money than he knows what to do with. Isn't that great? And the consequences of that become apparent later on, but not like it's not really shown throughout the movie. And the things you're saying too, Dave, like the broader impact of like the drug trade. Oh man, you're making millions of dollars, but where is this stuff going? What is it? You know, how is it impacting the rest of the society? This feels like a great Netflix special. Like I would have loved to see like 3 to 6 episodes of this, similar to Narcos or something that really dives into it and gives us a sense of it. And honestly, the movie too, like it doesn't look that great. Like it has some 70s vibes, but it feels.
I think it looks pretty good. That's my opinion.
There's like a cheapness to it to me, like given how great, you know, stuff we're seeing on Netflix and Amazon and whatnot here now. The movie felt slight in so many ways because it wasn't super focused and because like, you know, yeah, the airplane scenes look fantastic, but certain elements of the film like just feel like it was cheap in a way. And maybe that's just the narrative, right? They couldn't really go too deep into any of this and they kind of had to paint with broad strokes. But I do give the movie credit, like the amoral aspects of it, like not quite like basically just having him do terrible things and like no one's really judging him and he's just kind of winning from it. And I think some people may take away the wrong message from this until you get to the end of the movie. So, and at least it shows like the downsides of that.
Right. Lindsay, I think, brought up a great comparison of like Wolf of Wall Street, which is again, another movie that I think shows a lot of upside of what it's like to live that kind of life and some downside. But that ultimately like you as the viewer need like will take away from that story what you will. And that actually happened with Wolf of Wall Street. A lot of people found that movie inspiring as a way to like live their own lives.
I just fundamentally disagree that there's anything, there's any character flaw in Tom Cruise.
All right, let's talk about that in spoiler. I do want to challenge you on that front, Jeff, and get into specifics when we talk about that. I want to ask you guys this question, though. Are any of you caught up with Narcos by any chance?
Not fully.
No
one's caught up with Narcos. Yeah, okay. Well, I was just wondering like how that kind of compares to this, because they're both movies about the drug trade. They both feature Pablo Escobar.
Well, it's funny Narcos season one is a lot deeper. Like that is kind of more of what I wanted.
Yeah, I mean, even in season one, you know, I didn't watch the whole thing. I got tired of the show about halfway through the first season. but even in what I watched, I felt like was a deeper exploration of the characters behind the drug trade than this movie was.
Yeah, this movie's uninterested in that at all. But it's also I found it pretty interesting that you know, if you watch Narcos, you come away thinking Pablo Escobar is like this kingpin at the center of everything. And if you watch American Made, he seems like a side character.
He's like a total side character in this movie.
Yeah. I didn't even know that it was Pablo Escobar until I looked at the IMDb page afterwards. I'm not going to lie. So that's how much it doesn't make him like a very relevant character.
I think there's very few characters other than Tom Cruise that make any kind of impression in this film at all.
Yeah.
Other than the great shirtless Caleb Landry Jones.
Yes, Caleb Landry Jones will never not be creepy in movies, and I thought he was very, very effective in this movie.
Poor guy. Also, I don't think this is another one of those movies where the wife character just doesn't get treated well. Like she gets a sense of her own later on. She really challenges Barry Seal, Tom Cruise's character, against like a lot of his bullshit later on. But I don't like the way like her, the first couple scenes we see of her at some point is basically her, you know, getting all dolled up to have sex with him and then straight to cuts, just like 3 or 4 rapid fire sex scenes, like one after another, which is kind of funny, but we don't even know the wife other than her being a sex bot by that point. Like that is really weird.
Yeah, that was really disappointing for me. She's basically not even a character really at all. In real life too, he had 3 different wives during this time. So I think it's kind of interesting that they decided to make her one and then also kind of nothing. I don't know.
It points to what I'm saying, I think, which is that he's just like this family man. He's just doing it for the family. Mm-hmm. Everything is glossed over of any kind of wrinkle that might make him seem like a despicable fella. But,
right.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about American Made in spoilers for the film starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course...
You're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
So, I mean, Jeff, I think the part of the movie that I got a sense of the movie taking a position on the character of Barry Seal is when he like rips his family out of their home, mm-hmm. And has to move them all overnight and moves them into this horrible place. And
but I mean, they end up loving it. It's all great. He's doing it out of love. He's doing it out of protection. That same type of thing happens in other movies like this. When my brain. Sorry, guys. I get very little sleep these days, so I'm having a hard time pulling up actor or character names out of the back of my brain. But the lead in Goodfellas does bizarre stuff, and it is chaos. It is ridiculous, and you see this crumbling of the foundation of his life. You see, you know, him building up this relationship and then it just hollowing out because of the mania that mm-hmm. comes from living like this. Nothing like that happens with Barry Seal. He's a fantastic guy who loves his wife and she loves him, and all he wants to do is protect her, and he's trying to make sure that she has enough money later on when the shit hits the fan. And oh man, he's just one hell of a great guy. I think for me, throughout the movie, there's no downside to Barry Seal. Even in that moment, you kind of feel for him, like, well, what was he going to do? He was given no choice by the FBI.
Right.
He's just a pawn. He's just a puppet. He has no agency. He's just being, you know, used by all these greater powers that are really the problem. He's just some good fellow who's trying to have fun in the skies. No big deal.
I could see that. And the movie definitely could have like stressed more the family issues, and him going through multiple marriages, I think would have made that a lot clearer, right? Like the impact this has on his overall family structure. But at the same time, like he just does things right. And when we meet him in this movie, he's already smuggling Cuban cigars. You know, he's already he's doing criminal things at the beginning. And that, you know, gets the interest of the CIA. And then he starts, it almost feels like the CIA in a way invites him to start being shady and doing things like, oh, you'll figure it out. You'll figure out a way to make more money.
They certainly don't seem to have a problem with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the movie doesn't quite judge him for it. But at the same time, I think you as a human being with, you know, a brain of your own, your own sense of moral judgment can be like, this is really fucked up. Like, what is happening here? And maybe the movie could do a better job of some of those things, but I actually think the way it in a way kind of glosses it over, or just like it doesn't even judge it. It's just like it's happening. Oh, he's trading drugs now. He's trading guns now. He's making a ton of money doing it. So it's successful. I think it's a very like that's a very like American, like a very pro-capitalist way of viewing it. But that's also, I think, part of the commentary, too. Right.
Well,
it's just like that's how it was happening.
Comparing it to a movie, you know, like how we see Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie whose name I can't even think
Wolf
of right
Wall
now.
Street.
Wall Street. Wall Street. I get very little sleep, you guys.
Jeff's brain is just shutting down as the podcast is going on.
Much. Yeah. It is much. And honestly, yeah. So I got about 4 hours of sleep last night. Anyway, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, yes, all these wonderful things happen to him. He's living a life that you could perceive as being, you know, master of the universe, right? But you see a hollowness to all of it. He has no substantive relationships. Everything is fraying at the seams. There's a mania to all of that. Nothing like that with Tom Cruise. He's a great dude. He has a strong family life. Everybody likes him. Every employee is fantastic. He protects the people in his life. He doesn't even want to kill that brother-in-law. He's trying to save the brother-in-law. Oops, he killed him. It's like he's a fantastic dude who has no problems until the very end of this movie.
It also, like, it never, I was kind of unclear. So he's, you know, flying to like Nicaragua like every day. Mm-hmm. How long is he gone? Like, that's something else you don't really get the sense of. Like, you don't even see him like miss a soccer game or like, know, like there's no sense of it impacting his family in any way, even though he's presumably gone like 90% of the time.
Yeah,
and it just feels doesn't
like
even
Nicaragua
talk about
is
that.
Like a hop, skip, and a jump, basically.
Yeah, like he just like I don't know, I was driving down the street or something. It's strange.
I will say, you know, something that was... So it sounds like you agree with Jeff's assessment, Lindsay.
I do, 100%. Yeah, that was my big problem for me also, especially with, you know, I'm glad that they kind of avoided the, like, naggy wife thing, because that can be really annoying and stuff also. But the fact that his wife doesn't really seem to have any kind of commentary on the fact that, like, the money that they're using to buy their, like, mansion is... dirty money, you know, there's no real, you don't see her input at all from any of that, and I, like, just found it strange.
Even if she was for it, even if she, like, embraced it, that would have been good to see.
Like, Skylar wanted it or something. Yeah, like, if they tried to, like, make it, she just didn't seem to have an opinion about it at all.
Yeah,
so.
You know, I did think that scene was a little bit moving when she has all the jewelry on her and she starts, like, ripping it off. I did think that was, like, that gave me a hint of a far better movie that this could have been.
But it wasn't very consistent with who she was before, because she suddenly just then cares about, like...
Yeah, like, why did she put all that stuff on in the first place if she really...
Yeah. Exactly.
I will say another weakness of this film, guys. Donal Gleason. it's pronounced Donal. I love this guy's work. Ex Machina, The Revenant, Star Wars, The Force Awakens... great actor. I thought this is one of my least favorite performances of his.
It's a very curious role for him. Yeah.
I just think he was woefully miscast in this role. Like, I don't know what they were even going for with that character.
All-American fixer.
Yeah, like, he's just kind of this fixer, like, very overconfident, swaggery. I just felt like it did not work with this guy's talents. And that was another big part of the weakness of the movie for me. Like, I think if there had been a lot of chemistry between Gleason and Cruise, right? I felt like that could have worked a little bit better. What did you think, Lindsay, of that character?
Yeah, no, I love Donald Gleason. He's one of my favorite actors. And I was excited to see this movie almost solely because of him, because I just think he's really interesting. And he was just a big old nothing for me. He didn't have any personality. I realized some of that was kind of by design, that he's like, you know, you don't even know his real name and whatever. But yeah, I also just had no idea what they were going for. At first, I thought maybe it was like he's the young guy and it was going to be that kind of thing. But... that wasn't really an issue. There were no, like, mentalities bumping against each other, you know. They didn't have any chemistry as just actors. It sucked. I think if that had been, again, not to keep bringing up Wolf of Wall Street, but you think of, like, Kyle Chandler in that movie and his, like, antagonism kind of with Leonardo DiCaprio makes that so, like, much more interesting, and this just didn't have any of that.
It's a specific type of charisma. Actually, that's a better Tom Cruise role. The ages probably wouldn't check out, but he would have been like the charismatic CIA fixer dude to convince some hapless, you know, idiot to do this work for him.
Yeah,
if they had like flipped those characters.
Yeah, imagine if Donald Gleason and Tom Cruise had played opposite roles in this movie. It might have been a much better film.
Donald Gleason would have been married to someone his own age. That would have been interesting.
Well, that was my favorite part of the film, is there's this moment in the movie when Caleb Landry Jones, they're like, oh my gosh, you're dating a 15-year-old. Meanwhile, Tom Cruise's wife in this movie, the actress, is 20 years younger than him.
I just
thought, it's a bit rich, Tom Cruise.
She's not 15.
That's true.
It's a little different.
It's a little different, but still a bit rich.
I think, Lindsay, you bring up the youth thing with Donald Gleason, and that is the thing that worked for me. I got that he was this upwardly mobile kind of ladder climber inside the CIA and willing to put up with a lot of bullshit that somebody else might not, i.e. illegal activity on the on the part of his, you know, prime deliverer of info, simply because he wanted to wow his superiors and the people that had been around longer than he. That's what I bought about the casting of him in that role was, you know, he's just there trying to deliver the goods, and he doesn't care what Tom Cruise does in order to get him the goods, because he's just this young kid who's trying to make it all work. Like, he doesn't even care about the ramifications.
Right.
Yeah. I think sometimes it was a writing problem too, less than a Donald Gleason problem. Just like, I was always a little unclear of like how much he knew of what Tom Cruise was doing. And, you know, that just, it was not clear to me at all until it starts to kind of click into place a little as it goes along, but
there's hints of better films in American Man. You know, you bring up Wolf of Wall Street, But this movie could have also been like a great ensemble film. And I felt like it almost wanted to be. You know when I realized... You know when I realized this movie failed at being an ensemble film is in the final sequence of the movie where they do this thing that all biopics do, which is it's like shows you the real life person, or it either shows you a real life photo of the person that, you know, is depicted in the film, or it does like the overlaid text and says like, you know, in real life, so-and-so went on to, you know, live a good life with 2.3 kids
in real life. It does like give you that, and then they opened a school, and or you know,
right?
They grew up to, you know,
yeah, exactly, or both. Sometimes it's both. It does like the photos of the real life people and the true story. But
I love the photos of the real life people thing. In fact, if a movie is based on real life and doesn't have the photos of the real people at the end, I get actively upset. Yes.
Wow. Okay. All right.
I need that in my based on a true story movies.
I actually disagree. That. You know, actually, we can have an argument about this, but let me finish my point, Jeff, which is...
No, let's have the
argument. No. I trust me, Jeff. I want to have the argument, but... and we are going to have the argument, but... the thing that made me realize that this movie had fundamentally failed in some way was when at the end of the movie they're like, so-and-so, like Barry Seal's friend, you know, went on to be in prison for blah and became like a preacher or whatever. And I was like, I don't even know that dude's name. You know,
which one was he?
About that guy.
Yeah. Like, who was that dude?
Yeah, he literally had two scenes, and he was like known as Bearded Dude.
Yeah, it's just like what?
Oh, Bearded Dude had a life that went beyond the confines of this film.
I also wonder, I don't know if this is true or not, but I got the sense that maybe something was cut or there was like another storyline, because Jesse Plemons was in this movie for like 2 minutes. And he's like a pretty big actor. And Lola Kirk was the other actress who's in scenes with him, who's also fairly – she was in Mistress America and
right. Why would
Gone
you get
Girl.
Those people unless
yeah.
there was – it felt
Good
like
point.
Maybe there was like a 3-hour cut of this movie. You know, who knows?
Yeah, it had to have been, because I don't know why you would just put those people in there to like barely be in it and have no lines really.
I kept waiting for that sheriff to sniff out the stuff that was going on inside of town.
I thought that's what was going to happen too, especially when I first saw him. I was like, oh, he's going to do something. And then he just like never. Really does.
Let's argue about real life photos at the end of biopics. Lindsay Romaine, you have an opinion on this?
So in this case, I think it would be hard because I don't think any of these people even existed. Like Tom Cruise's wife wasn't a real person.
Right.
I don't know that those guys helping him from what I understand, the story is pretty different in real life. So,
right.
I mean, if.
Well, I'm just saying generally, not necessarily this film, but like generally.
I have one more point about that. Also, the guy who Tom Cruise is playing in real life was like a 350-pound man, which the movie just like obviously probably couldn't do, because then it would be a very different movie, but. It would be kind of funny if they did do the picture thing in that case. And you'd be like, oh, wow, he was like a very large man in real life.
So realistic.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't really care, to be honest. I think sometimes it's nice, but sometimes it kind of sucks you out of the movie when you see them. They look so different. You're like,
it always sucks me out of the movie. Another movie that had it recently was like Argo. Also, we just saw Battle of the Sexes.
Yeah.
That movie
Battle
had
the Sexes, yeah.
Right. And it's like... I'm just like, every time I see a photo of a real life person in a biopic, I'm like, oh, right. What we were just watching was a festival of lies. You know, that's my reaction.
Usually the actors are like beautiful. Yeah.
That's a good thing to be reminded of, Dave.
Yeah. Jeff, tell us why you're upset if it's not in there.
I want to know what those people looked like. I want to know that thing that they did. Show me a picture of it. Show me what was it really like? Well, who are they standing around? How close did this movie get to real life circumstances? I think it's required. If you're based on a true story, give me that picture of the thing. Show me the thing.
I mean, I agree with all that stuff you said. I like knowing the difference between real life and the movie, but I don't know that like a few photos at the end and some like 5 sentences of text really communicates all that. You know,
it's
like
so satisfying though.
No, I was just gonna say it's hard to again not like to use this movie as an example when it's not people that really exist, or it's like they're not even really playing these people sometimes. So it's I don't know, that makes it kind of funky too. Like,
I think it does a disservice to real. I think it does a disservice to real life because then it makes you think like, oh yeah, like you know, you just saw this movie. By the way, here's the real thing, just so you, like, verisimilitude, like, the movie is a pretty accurate representation of what, you know what I mean? And I feel like, no, it's not. Anyway, I hate the practice. I hate the
battle
practice.
Battle of the Sexes, for example, there's, like, just a quick moment in that movie with a photo shoot with Bobby Riggs doing that naked thing. And then you get to see the real picture that happened at the end. And you're like, yeah, he really did that. That really happened. That's the stuff that I need to – I need it. I need to know, that really was a thing that they recreated for the movie. It wasn't just a fabrication of some idea that the writer had in a room. Like, yeah, give me that. Give me that. What's the movie with all the wonderful ladies that worked at NASA as the
Hidden Figures?
Hidden Figures.
Oh, that movie did a great job of that. Like, yeah, they were real ladies. Look at them. They're standing in front of the place that we just saw them in for the last 2 hours. Yeah, that really happened. Look at them.
All right. I will say I usually go home and Google it anyway, so yeah, maybe I should be.
Exactly. That's what I do. Lindsay, I'm in the same boat as you. That's exactly how I do it.
Yeah.
It's just removing a step.
All right. Fair enough, Jeff. Fair enough. All right, guys. Any closing thoughts on American Made? It sounds like it had some pleasures, some thrills, but none of us were too taken by it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I had one more thing to point out. I thought it was kind of weird that there were like the weird like president cameos in the movie where it was like, oh, here's George W. Bush. And then there's like the weird Bill Clinton, like, I don't know. They're just like,
yeah, when that they moment.
Yeah.
With George W. Bush where he's in the lobby and he's like, Junior, come in here. And it's like, okay. W was around.
It was just really distracting. And then the Bill Clinton like on the phone thing. It's like, okay, like, okay, now we know what year this takes place in. I don't know. It was weird.
I mean, I agree. It was kind of like out there, but I think like the movie is trying. It might not be succeeding, but it's trying to kind of make this argument about American excess, right? And that like tying it in.
More of that kind of thing, like throughout, it would have been less jarring than like the two times they like ram it in your face.
Yeah, right. It kind of builds up really quickly at the end. Where things get, the shit really hits the fan for this movie, and then I kind of wanted more of that and less of like him wasting time.
I have to say, it was a bizarre ending. Yeah, you know, I thought it was a bizarre ending where they don't even show his execution. Like that was a thing that really it actually kind of bothered me because I felt like if the movie's making an argument about that's where I really felt like the movie was amoral. Jeff, was if you're gonna show this guy kind of pissing off all these drug lords and stuff. There are horrible consequences of that, namely an awful death alone in a parking lot. Like that's what's going to happen to this guy. And I felt like the movie didn't show that. It cut away before he was executed, and it made it seem almost it showed almost none of the downside of the drug trade. And that was a big disappointment. Yeah. I'm okay with you saying like, hey, it's amazing. But even like Wolf of Wall Street, like you see how it's like destroying his family. Again, Jeff, I guess I'm coming over to your side now. You know, like with Goodfellas, it's like it shows, you know, how it's like destroying his family life as well. And all the effects it has on his health and stuff. You know, like this movie didn't show any of the downsides. And that was kind of I just found it a bizarre decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his wife even seemed happy at the end. Like when it cuts to her, she's like just happily wearing her jewelry. So.
Yeah. I love working at KFC.
She's like super psyched apparently.
Yeah.
So
the other thing is they make such a huge deal of those VHS tapes, and then we get no closure on what happened to them, if they had any relevant. Like the whole movie is framed inside these tapes, and we assume that someone's going to find them at the end, but there's no. We get no.
Well, they do find them. Closure. They do find them, but then it's like, what happens as a result of that? Like nothing.
It's really weird. They already know everything.
Yeah.
So. Like, are we watching these because no one else did?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It is really weird. It is really weird. Anyway, American Made, not as good as Live, Die, Repeat, unfortunately, but it's out in theaters right now, and I would say of The Mummy and Jack Reacher Never Go Back, it is the least bad of those three films.
Is the least bad, but probably wait for watch it at home.
You know, wait for it to be at home, and also wait for Mission Impossible 6, which I'm guessing is going to be the last time Tom
Cruise. Nothing can go wrong with this movie.
Nothing can go wrong with Mission Impossible 6. All right, find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from AdamWarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be reviewing next week. In the meantime, Lindsay Romaine, where can people find more of your work on the internets this week?
Yeah, you can follow me at Lindsay Romaine on Twitter, just first and last name. I'm also covering American Horror Story this season for Thrillist, and then I'll be at Slash Film and a bunch of other places. Just check my Twitter.
All right. How about you, Jeff Cannata?
You can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I have several other shows, including two video game shows. I have a daily video game show, just 10 minutes a day, keeps you up to date. It's called Newest, Latest, Best. You can find it on iTunes or Google Play Music, anywhere you find podcasts. Or you can find it on Anchor, which is at anchor.fm/NLB. I have a weekly video game show called DLC. We just recorded our 200th episode.
Congrats.
Of DLC this week. Thank you very much. That's at 5by5.tv/DLC. And I have a comedy science show called We Have Concerns that you can find at wehaveconcerns.com.
How about you, Devendra Hardwar?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech at Engadget.com.
All right, and find all of my stuff at DaveChen.net. I'm also on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. Next week, we're going to be reviewing the new Denis Villeneuve movie, Blade Runner 2049. Really psyched. You guys have already seen this movie, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Really excited.
I'll probably be seeing it before the review.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did have that theory, that way of interpreting Denis Villeneuve's movies. Take the title of any Denis Villeneuve movie, put it in the following sentence, but who's the real blank? That is the theme of said movie.
It still works.
Who's the real Arrival?
Yeah, the real Arrival? People keep saying that to me as though that doesn't actually make sense.
I
think it does.
It still stands.
I think it totally works.
What is the real Arrival?
Is the real Arrival? Exactly, yeah.
But it works. Who is the real Blade Runner 2049?
They're just making fun of your
career. Makes more sense than you think.
I wish the 2049 wasn't in there. But yeah, who's the real enemy? Who's the real prisoner? I love all this guy's movie. I kid because I love all this guy's movies, even Prisoners. So, all right, guys, lots to look forward to next week. Thanks for listening to the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. We'll see you later.
This is Acast Recommends. Every week we pick one of our favourite shows, and this is one we think you're going to love.
Who exploded Vivian Stone? Was it screen hunk Mick Salad?
Mother's Digest called me dependably erotic.
Leading lady Joanna Shoebags.
Oh, you call me dramatic again, I will die!
First time director Wallace Byrne Matravers.
I think I'll just keep my clothes on for now.
Assistant director Laura Side Salad.
If I can help you direct this film, I can certainly help direct your Winkle.
Technician James Wigington.
You've got a funny way of addressing a man holding a power drill.
Or someone else entirely. Listen in to find out who exploded Vivian Stone.
Acast is home to the biggest podcasts from the UK and around the world. Subscribe to this show and hundreds more now via Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.